This is Tom Fox, and I'd like to welcome you to Innovation in Compliance. In this podcast series, I will bring you interviews with some of the leading experts who are changing the way practitioners approach compliance. Although the name compliance is in the title, it's really about innovation. And I wanted to drive the conversation about innovation in compliance into the 2030s and beyond, with a focus on innovations for the compliance practitioner and the compliance professional. You want to learn how to bring your business into an innovative state and more innovative business solutions for compliance problems, issues, and concerns. This is the podcast for you. Innovation in Compliance is a production of Compliance Podcast Network. Today I visit with Keith Laska. Keith has transitioned from a compliance and data focus over to Bitcoin. We have a fascinating discussion about Bitcoin, his role as a professor in the arena of this most interesting topic. First, a message from the sponsor of the Compliance Podcast Network this month, Ethico.
In the intricate world of ethics and compliance, each second is precious, and slow case closures are more than just delays, they're missed opportunities. Enter Ethico. Our solution revolutionizes case management, cutting closure times in half and turning every challenge into a chance for improvement. Imagine a workspace where efficiency and compliance coexist harmoniously. Don't just dream of faster resolutions, make it your reality. Visit ethico.com/CPN today to book a demo and dive into our exclusive white paper by Tom Fox, The ROI of Compliance, and to try our free ROI calculator. Empower your team with the tools they deserve.
Hello, everyone. This is Tom Fox, and you're in for a real treat today because, as usual, I'm in for a real treat. And the reason we're both in for real treats is we're visiting with Keith Laska. I can't tell you how long I've known Keith, but it's been quite a while. You might remember him from the compliance world, but he's in a different world now, and he's here to tell us about it. Keith, with that incredibly long-winded introduction, first of all, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Tom. It's a pleasure always to be with you on this.
Keith, could you tell our audience about your professional background and what you're up to today?
I would love to, and I'll try to make it brief, although the years are coming upon me. We'll do the best we can. I started out my career as an instructor in French and Italian over at Phillips Exeter Academy in Exeter, New Hampshire, nice secondary school up there. And then I ventured into business, started within the translation industry, working for about 15 years in the translation industry in various roles. That industry took me to the UK, where I lived and worked for about 7 years. And then eventually came back in 2011 and then started a media tech company and then eventually became CEO of a compliance and legal tech company called Hanzo. I now teach as a professor at Fordham University. I teach Bitcoin and blockchain, and I have recently launched a company called learnbitcoin.io, which is targeting education for the next 1 billion Bitcoiners around the world.
So a lot to unpack from that, but where I wanted to start, Keith, is I haven't had the opportunity to have anyone on the podcast who could bring us through the history of Bitcoin to where we are in 2024 and where we may be in my new favorite phrase, mid-century, 2030 and beyond. Could you give us a quick primer on the origin of Bitcoin and how it grew through the last decade of this century and how it exploded during the pandemic?
Absolutely. So Bitcoin's about 15 years old. People don't realize that. But to understand the origins of Bitcoin, you need to pedal backwards a little bit to the invention of the Federal Reserve in 1913. So most people, your listeners, your viewers, are vaguely or very familiar with the Federal Reserve. They basically manage monetary policy and have done so for over a century. Their jobs are twofold. It's to maintain employment, so realistic employment numbers, and also contain inflation. The Fed did a decent job of wrangling in some of the early issues we had with decentralized banking. But unfortunately, it was in the 1970s that the US dollar was actually depegged from gold. And in 1971, Richard Nixon made that temporary move, which still exists today. And we now have a situation where the United States dollar is backed by the full faith and credit of the United States, as are central bank currencies around the world. The problem with that is that it has given governments the ability to press the print button on fiat currencies over and over, whether there's a catastrophe or a potential war to fund or just need excess spending. The US dollar has become something of a money printing output. And the issue with that is it's inflation is effectively a tax on those that have non-variable income. So in 2008, after the crash, the huge crash, there was this anonymous independent cypherpunk who posted on an anonymous wall, cypherpunk wall, and basically said, I've invented a new form of money that solves for one of the biggest issues that digital money has ever faced with the new internet age, and that is the double spend problem. So I have figured out, basically, this anonymous person said, how to create money that does not require the trust of a third party or central bank to operate. It's basically peer-to-peer money. And it was just a project, really, from 2009 onwards until it started to get notoriety in 2013 when it went from a penny to $1,200. And then everybody thought it was dead again. And then it went from a couple of dollars up to $20,000. And everybody thought it was dead again. And it went from $20,000 up to $70,000. And all of a sudden, it's just not going away. This is all culminated in the last few months where this nascent embryonic cypherpunk project born 15 years ago is now a part of 11 spot ETFs launched by some of the largest asset managers in the world, including BlackRock, Fidelity, and Invesco. So we've really come far in terms of Bitcoin's growth and evolution.
So in terms of the ETFs, were those the ones that were approved by the Securities and Exchange Commission earlier this year?
They were, correct. Yeah.
And what's the significance of that?
Sure. For years, most of the regulatory agencies would not approve a spot ETF. Now, many of your listeners will remember 2004 when the first gold ETF, the spot gold ETF, was launched at a strike price of about $40. It then went on a parabolic run that ended in just a few years ago at roughly $2,000 per troy ounce. The issue with Bitcoin is the SEC had approved a number of futures ETFs trading on derivatives, but they had not approved spot ETFs. And the big difference is a spot ETF requires you to take Bitcoin off of the market if somebody buys your ETF. And that's what's so big about the last few months. We now actually have a set of spot Bitcoin ETFs, which, by the way, have outperformed 98.8% of other ETFs this year already in about 20 trading days, and also are basically, as BlackRock says, the most successful ETFs ever launched, and they've launched 576 of them.
So you mentioned the growth in value of Bitcoin. Is Bitcoin an investment, or can it also be seen as an alternative monetary system?
That's such a good question, Tom. I think it depends on where you live and what your particular use case is. In the United States, Bitcoin, since its evolution, has had a CAGR, a compound annual growth rate, of roughly 160, 170% per year. Okay. I think if you're investing in Bitcoin in the United States, you're probably thinking a year out, 10 years out, maybe generationally, or as a legacy investment for your family. And that makes sense. It becomes a store of value at that point in time. It beats inflation. However, if you're down in Argentina or Turkey or Lebanon, where inflation rates can be in excess of 100%, you are running towards Bitcoin because it's a harder form of money than the Argentinian peso or the Turkish lira. So I think for them, it's probably a little bit more of a medium of exchange, right? They're not worried about generational returns. They're worried about bread on the table tomorrow.
We talked a little bit about the exchanges, and one of the things that struck me was some of the major financial players in America were part of that group of 12. Could you talk about how you see either financial services organizations or banks actually interacting with Bitcoins going forward, or maybe even down the road?
Yeah, in multiple ways. Banks will more likely than not be allowed to custody Bitcoin on behalf of their clients at some point in the future, in the same way they custody cash, stocks, whatever it happens to be. They will provide these custody services and provide some element of yield off of them and do the same thing they probably have done, which is lend that out and rehypothecate that. So I think custody services would be big. But an interesting point of clarity or confusion, depending on your level of knowledge of Bitcoin, is that it's more than just a potential money system. Yes, Tom, I could open up my phone right now at 9 o'clock at night and the banks are all closed and I can send you Bitcoin in a fraction of an instant, right? I did not need a bank to send you that money. However, what people don't know is above beyond a money system, Bitcoin is actually a technology. And as a technology, you can build on top of Bitcoin. So eventually I see banks and organizations, and I can see compliance and legal departments really getting their hands dirty in this, in terms of trying to understand it and use it for good, is the ability to build technology on top of Bitcoin, like smart contracts. So a solid money system with smart contracts on top makes it a really powerful offering.
One of the things that I have thought about in terms of Bitcoin is the anonymity and how compliance function would work around that to provide the government or whomever the regulators might be assurances this is not being used by anonymous, nefarious players. How should we think through that issue, Keith?
Such a good question, Tom. I tend to get this a lot. The first thing I would say is I would urge us to focus on the 90% as opposed to the 10%, or in this case, 98% as opposed to 2%. 98% of the world's illicit activity, money laundering, fraud, theft, all of these bad things is actually managed through US dollars, not Bitcoin. The United Nations believe it's somewhere between $1.4 and $4 trillion a year that's actually used for illicit activity. So before we actually concentrate on something that's less than $1 trillion in value, we should probably look at cleaning that up. But I would say if you anticipate using Bitcoin for nefarious activity, I would warn you against it. Every single transaction that is sent and or received on Bitcoin's network is clearly and openly accessible to everybody. It's like having an online Excel spreadsheet of every transaction for Bitcoin since its inception. You can't get that from your bank, by the way, but you can get it from Bitcoin. So if I send you a transaction, I send you $10 in Bitcoin, and then you send a dollar to 10 different people from the $10 I sent you, we can track the provenance of all of those transactions from the starting point of where I got my Bitcoin from, all the way to where that Bitcoin ends up. And of course, with exchanges KYCing, all you need is a Bitcoin wallet address attached to a KYC, and you really have, you know exactly who sent the money. So I would never advise somebody who's doing something fraudulently, but I would certainly say don't do it on Bitcoin's blockchain because you'll be found.
I thought and wrote a lot about the possibilities of contracts in blockchain for compliance. For one of the reasons was what you just described, the transparency, obviously the immutability, I said that word. But it struck me when I looked into blockchain contracts that this would be a great boon for compliance. Is that a valid assessment, or did I get it wrong?
Absolutely. The ability to shore up inefficiencies in the compliance overall compliance process is something that blockchains are destined to do. But I think the real interesting formula, the soup, comes together when you actually attach AI to blockchains. Then what you have is efficiency on steroids, pretty much. And I do think both of those technologies are solidifying themselves and maturing themselves over the next few years. If you take AI models and then you take Bitcoin's blockchain, you can do an enormous amount of efficiency gains and other things with that combination.
Could you give us a hint of a couple of the things you might be able to do with those combinations?
Yeah, one interesting use case might be to store the existing rules and regulations for your compliance department or your industry on a blockchain, and then have AI scour the internet to find out what pending or potential regulation is coming down the pike. And then you can basically retrofit your compliance program and get a head start on those particular compliance new laws or regulations that are coming out, and literally cut months, if not years, out of the process. Just think about how long it took for GDPR to be implemented. The EU had talked about it for years, and there are still companies that are grappling with the final touches of their GDPR program. You're talking probably 50, 60% advance in efficiencies by storing information immutably in the blockchain, and then another 20% perhaps on the acceleration of AI crawling to find those regulations and laws worldwide, not just in the US, that could pertain to your particular business.
Keith, I'd like to turn to your work in the academic world now. So I'm the son of a professor, so I'm always interested in anyone who does that. And I have taught at several universities, generally around compliance issues. It took about 5, sometimes 10 years for universities to really bring in some sort of compliance expertise. You're in here in a much quicker realm. And I really wanted to ask, to start asking, what has been the reception of the student body to your class or classes?
For sure. So when I was first approached by Fordham, given my experience as a compliance tech and legal tech CEO, they asked me to teach a compliance class. And I'm in the compliance and ethics group within Fordham Law School. But I wasn't overly interested in picking up one of those classes. And then they asked me, what would you like to teach? And I said, Bitcoin and blockchain. That's novel and it has a lot to do with compliance and ethics in the future. And so they approved it. And I was really excited about it because I got to write my own syllabus and then send it out to see what kind of reception there was. The signups for the class were oversubscribed on the first go around. Now, I will caveat that and say we were in the middle of a raging bull market for Bitcoin. Everybody and their brother and mother had already purchased it and were excited about it. So the oversubscription, more likely than not, came from the fact that it was a very talked about topic at that point in time. And interestingly enough, over the years, I've seen the interest increase and wane depending on what's happening with Bitcoin's price and the excitement in the marketplace. But if I dot plotted it, it would be up and to the right in terms of interest. The students come in, understand it. They're from compliance backgrounds and legal backgrounds, banking, commercial establishments. And 90% come in skeptical and if not confused about the topic. And we spend a lot of time not just walking through what Bitcoin is, but hands-on work, transferring coin to each other in classes and things like that. I'll say that 80 to 90% at the end of the class understand it and can speak fluently about it. And then there's always 10 to 20% that really get heavily involved in the Bitcoin industry after that.
Another observation I had was that in many ways, people like myself and yourself are training a new generation of compliance professionals, but you're training the first generation of Bitcoin professionals. I was wondering, do you have any sense of that? Or do you feel like we're all in this together in this exploration and journey? What's that like?
I think, was it Bill Gates who said you overestimate what you can do in a year and underestimate what you can do in 10 years? I feel like the Bitcoin industry is like that. There's a lot of excitement. There's a lot of hope. There's promise within the industry, but it always takes longer for these things to be implemented than people expect. You and I have been talking about AI since, what, the 90s, perhaps even earlier. It's just got a different label attached to it now. So I think preparation is critical. My class provides continuing, or I should say learnbitcoin.io provides continuing education credits for financial advisors and wealth managers, CFP and IWI credits. And when I speak with them, I realize how early we are as well. They really are just at the beginning stages of wanting to learn about this, even though right in front of their eyes, the biggest asset managers are offering these spot Bitcoin ETFs. So I think it's going to take a while. It's almost like a hurry up and wait scenario with learning about this stuff.
One of the things that has always struck me about you, Keith, is you are intensely curious and you're almost a lifelong learner, maybe just a lifelong learner. I'm that same way. And so I wanted to maybe turn to the company Learn Bitcoin, because when you put these classes on or when you train professionals around Bitcoin, do you see a younger generation embrace it and see it as a new opportunity? Does it strike people our age who are just intensely curious and say, oh, let me learn about this? Is it a mix? Is it all of the above, none of the above, or some of the above?
I'd say about 80% of those that have come onto the platform are professionals, right? They're either financial advisors, wealth managers, compliance professionals, legal professionals, small business owners who want to learn how to accept Bitcoin in their businesses, even some fringe universities that are at the early stages of implementing a course like this into their core curriculum. 20%, however, are your mom and dad, the average person who's just Bitcoin curious. And they come on, and the interesting thing I've noticed is younger generation definitely get it. Mid-generations take a little bit convincing. Do you know who really gets it as well? Older generations, people who are 60, 70 years old and even older, because they remember their parents talking about when they were able to own their own gold in their houses before Executive Order 6102 came in under FDR in April 5th, 1933, when FDR basically said to everybody, submit your gold. We have a fiat crisis, we have a currency crisis, submit your gold or you're facing jail time and penalties. And so they remember their parents saying, we had to pull up our cupboards and we had to dig our gold out of the backyard and actually hand it into the government. They like the ability to be able to hold their own money again and self-custody their own money again. And that's the allure. So it's almost like a bookend. Young generation gets it, the older generation get it, and the middle have grown up with this heavily inflated stock market and really don't know much else. That's what I've seen.
That's a fascinating analysis. Keith, unfortunately, we are near the end of our time for this episode, but before we leave, I wanted to ask you if our listeners wanted any more information on yourself or what you're up to or the topics we've touched on, what might be the best place or places for them to go?
Sure. If you're interested and curious about Bitcoin, please visit learnbitcoin.io. There's a plethora of information up there, even free information to get you acquainted with the concept of Bitcoin. You can also follow me on my socials. So I'm Keith Laska on LinkedIn and at Keith Laska on X. And I post regularly about market insights there. Apart from that, hope to meet some of you all out there pretty soon and hope you start your Bitcoin journey at some point in the future.
Keith, thanks again, and I hope we can continue this conversation.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
This month, the Compliance Podcast Network is sponsored by Ethico. Are you struggling with budgeting and finance requests for your compliance program? Well, I've written a white paper together with Nick Gallo at Ethico, and we've made that available. So if you'll click through on the link, you can get a white paper on the ROI of compliance and how you can use that in the budgeting process. I know you will be able to use this white paper on ROI. Are you looking for a quick way to get some ideas for an upgrade for your compliance program? Well, I have a new podcast for you, the Compliance Tip of the Day, where in 5 minutes, you can find out a cutting-edge tip of compliance that you can implement or at least consider for your compliance program. Check out the Compliance Tip of the Day each day, Monday through Friday, on the Compliance Podcast Network.